One of the films that just showed at the Cannes Film Festival, The Plot Against Harry, took 20 years to get into theaters. It's a comedy, but no one laughed at the time it was made, so it was never released. A few months ago, we interviewed the writer and director, Michael Romer. That was a few weeks after the film had opened in New York. Since then, the film has been gradually opening in cities around the country. The Plot Against Harry centers around Harry Plotnick, a small-time numbers racketeer alienated from the values of his estranged middle-class Jewish family. The film opens as Harry gets out of jail. Before making The Plot Against Harry, Romer and Robert Young made the film Nothing But a Man, about a black couple in the South. I had read that Romer made The Plot Against Harry to get closer to his own experiences, but I wondered what a Harvard-educated filmmaker had in common with an ex-con.
Well, you know, there's an old affinity between so-called artists, filmmakers, writers, poets, painters, who I think often feel themselves to be outsiders, and that part of the society that operates on the lamb or on the outside, namely, you know, if not hoods and gangsters, well, confidence artists and people like that. So I think that I felt close to someone who was on the outside and trying to make it in and, you know.
Well, your movie is from the point of view of a small-time criminal's view of the Jewish middle class. Now, you were a different kind of outsider in a way, because you emigrated to the United States with no family, I believe, after the Holocaust. You grew up, I believe, in Germany and went to England during the war and then came to the States when you were a teenager. Can you tell me how you were sent to England on the children's transport? Who was chosen and how?
I don't know how the administration of those things worked. I know that late in 38, and then until September 39, when hostilities actually broke out and it all had to stop, parents in Germany became very, very alarmed, for very good reason, of course, and they started to look for any way to get their children out, even if they themselves couldn't get out. And there were these trains, I think there were 10,000 children all in all who went out that way, who went from Berlin to England. The parents just, you know, said goodbye at the railroad stations in Berlin and went on to, some of them went on to the next station. There are a lot of stations in these big European cities. And just to see the train go through one more time and to wave to the train, I didn't know that at the time. I didn't even look out the window, I don't think, but I know my mother said she was standing at the next station, waving to the train as it went by. It's a heartbreaking image if one thinks that a great many parents never, of course, saw their children again because they died. You know, the children never saw their parents again.
Did you have any idea why you were being sent away?
Vague, very vague. I knew about anti-Semitism. I mean, I was, in a very small, personal way, victimized by German kids on our street who had been my friends who suddenly turned on me because I was Jewish. But and I knew that my family was very upset, and my mother, my grandparents, and that the business they were in was being dismantled and destroyed. And but, you know, it's all I remember is that I was told to pack, and the next thing I remember is hoarding chocolate and putting it, endless bars of chocolate, into my suitcase and going to the train station. That's how I remember it. And then I remember a tremendous sense of relief in as soon as we crossed the German border. So I must have understood something.
So you spent the war years in England.
Yeah, I was in a school mostly for refugee children in England, a wonderful school, a really marvelous boarding school that is still, in many ways, my family, children who went to that school with me, and even the adults, I still, you know, I'm still in touch with some of them, and it is like a family, you know. For 6 years, I lived very intensively with 120 other children who, or a great many of them without parents, and
how did you come to the States?
Well, my mother actually got out in 1941, and she went to Portugal, and then from Portugal to the United States. And so when the war was drawing to its end, they permitted a certain number of of the young children, of the children, to rejoin family in the United States. And that's how my sister and I actually got out.
In your movie, The Plot Against Harry, Harry, who's the guy who runs the numbers racket, he decides to go legit and goes into a catering business with his ex-brother-in-law, Leo. And so this is a catering business that specializes in bar mitzvahs and weddings. And it strikes me that you probably didn't have an extended family in the States who were always inviting you to bar mitzvahs and weddings and stuff.
No, this was, of course, partly, again, I think you're quite astute. I've never thought of that part of it, but I think you've put your finger on something that is probably psychologically there, that I didn't have any of those things, and that I was the Harry who was trying to join it. You know, if that's what you were getting at, that's absolutely true. And of course, the whole East European community, East European Jewish community, was what I would look at with longing, with all its festivities and its sense of family. I was in a very small family, you know. There's no extended family that I remember at all, and very little sense of community. And so perhaps I think you're right. to point out that I sort of adopted that as something I wanted to be part of, and that part of the story comes out of that, you know.
Now, the way I understand what happened is when you first showed the Plot Against Harry to friends, to potential backers, to film executives, nobody laughed, right?
That's right.
Now everybody realizes that, you know, the film's gotten a wonderful reception. People think it's really pretty funny. What is it about the movie, or about your sense of humor as conveyed through the movie, that people didn't get then and that they do get now?
I wish I knew. I mean, everyone has been wondering about that, and I've said that I thought part of the problem was that originally the film moved too fast, which is true. At the time, 20 years ago, people couldn't pick up the information quickly enough. That was part of it. I think another part of it has to do with distance. If it's your own time and your own place and your own activity, it's harder to see the thing as funny. When you look from a distance, and that could be a distance in time, 20 years, then the things that seemed just photographic reality acquire a slightly different tonality, perhaps. It's a possibility. I honestly don't know. A third possibility could be that we are much more comfortable with ethnicity than we used to be, and that people were a little bit nervous or a little bit sensitive to the fact that this is a Jewish community that isn't already in the suburbs and lawyers and, you know, doctors and professors, but these are just ordinary, plain, middle-class and even lower-middle-class people. And they're just like every other ethnic community that's working its way into the middle class.
Can I offer another possibility, too?
Please do. I'll use it the next interview.
That I think the generation that was growing up while you were making the movie was a generation that grew up maybe slightly more alienated from their
absolutely.
Extended family.
I think that's absolutely part of it. And I think the film does speak to them, these younger people today, in just that way. I think there were people, perhaps already like me, as I was then, you know, who are now looking back at that period and enjoying the fact that there's an outsider being at a bar mitzvah, when perhaps they were just a little bit outside their own bar mitzvahs. Is that what you're saying?
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure that that's true, but it could be. I think that there is such a generation, perhaps.
You taught for many years. Are you still teaching?
Yeah. I still teach. I started before we started making Harry. I was asked to teach at Yale, and since I'd made so many movies just trying to make a living, this seemed like a very good alternative to making films I didn't want to make, just to keep, you know, our three children halfway closed and fed. And so I've been teaching for the last, since 1966, and I still teach.
Now that The Plot Against Harry has not only been released, but is really a wonderful success, what kind of offers are you getting now?
Well, it's interesting. People have projects, and they'd like to hire you to to direct their films, or possibly to adapt a book that they've bought the rights to. And my own experience is that I'm not really as good as many other people in doing that kind of thing, and that I need to stick with my own material and do that.
Do you have screenplays that are already written in your drawer, ready to go?
Yep, I always think if opportunity knocks, I'll have the door open before they finish knocking. I keep writing stories, and I don't go out and hustle money anymore. I've done that, but at this time, I'm unwilling to spend a year or a year and a half, as I did for my last film, just raising money. So I'm hoping that perhaps a miracle will happen again, as indeed it did with The Plot Against Harry. I mean, somebody literally came, man from Seattle, King Broadcasting, and said, "We liked your last film. What would you like to do?" And so we made Harry.
Michael Romer, he wrote and directed The Plot Against Harry.